Bold. Brave. Herb. With Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode 523 of the Bold and Brave Herb podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Samantha Boardman, and she's one of my faves over at the Wall Street Journal. And so there I was just sort of reading along, and there she had to, of course, publish a piece that I just absolutely have to share. Now, why is she so cool? I'm sharing her with you because she's a New York City-based psychiatrist, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the Cornell Medical College. She's the author of a book called Everyday Vitality, and she's the founder of PositivePrescription.com. She's all about positivity. Samantha, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Peek. I'm thrilled to be here and an honor to be your 523rd episode.
I know, it's like, gosh, that's a whole lot of talking, but you know, it's been a wild ride. So I read this piece and I want to have you share your insights about what you wrote here. And it's called Feeling Overwhelmed. You know, it's kind of like, why do you even ask? Feeling overwhelmed, don't trust your instincts about what to do next. And then you say, too often people think the best thing to do is conserve their mental energy and do less. In other words, the way I like to look at it is people become like little turtles. They go back in their shell and they say, you know something? It's too much. Too much. Bye-bye. I got to get out of here. And you're saying no? Now, why?
Well, exactly. I mean, the word overwhelmed actually is derived from this, I think it's a 15th century word from the Middle Ages that means to sort of feel engulfed, especially by a flood. In that sense, and I think when we speak to patients today and just everyone in general, that's how people are feeling and they want to retreat into that carapace, into that turtle-like shell. And we're just bombarded with too much information, too many things to worry about, too many interruptions, too many obligations and demands. And what do we do? Well, the typical response is avoidance and to withdraw. And that's actually the very opposite of what's going to help us feel stronger. And so I've really been interested in this idea of taking the opposite action. And because most of the time, like we're told, hey, trust your gut, do what feels right. But it's actually the opposite of that that ends up helping us feel stronger.
Now, you're saying that when you react that way, doing the little turtle thing that I mentioned, that it leaves us even more stressed, isolated, and depleted. Why?
Well, because in the short term, it sort of feels like the right move. Like I just need to conserve my energy and I just need to fixate on myself and I need to trust my feelings here. But what actually helps us feel strong? What boosts and bolsters and sort of builds our well-being? Well, it's not avoidance or withdrawal or retreating. It's really mobilizing our strengths, right? It's then doing things in connection with others. And then it, like the third thing it really is sort of taking action. Like what is, you know, your next step here? Otherwise, we're sort of living in this limbo, in this liminal space of like waiting, like, oh, as soon as this passes, maybe then I will take care of this or then I'll do that thing. And so we end up in this sort of weird liminal space, this sort of penumbra of misery, if you will, and not actually doing the things that help us feel strong, because it's actually sort of maybe a surprise to think about it, but happiness isn't all in our heads. I always say it's in the actions you take, the connections you make, and how you participate.
Absolutely. All of that rhymed. Are you a poet also? is you're starting to do the, you know, like I almost got a rhythm out of it. I was like doing a little dance. Yeah, I was doing the positivity dance over here. You know what I have found is, you know, look how we live today. Seriously, when we're not doom scrolling, then we're like immediately something floats across our feed. And just when we were like getting into an acid focus, boom, we're gone. And then we go down that rabbit hole. And next thing you know, 30 minutes went by. What happened? Now we're really stressed because we're behind. But something else floated across our feet. And then there was a text. Uh-oh. And that text looked a little provocative and compelling. What are we going to do with that text? Then there's a moment of indecision. Meanwhile, an hour's gone by. And before you know it, it's like your life is just sort of floating by with all of this overwhelm, distractibility, craziness. And then, God forbid, we get a headline that is an absolute showstopper. What? Bombing another country? What? You know, like, and you sit back and what do? You know what I am? I'm an absolute natureaholic. I just am. I'm an outdoor athlete. And so when all this stuff happens, you know what I do? I take my cell phone, I leave it home. And I call one of my dear, dear friends. I said, we're walking in nature now. That's a stat order. And oh my gosh, I just have to get out. Get out yes. to get in. Does that make
that's
sense?
That's a positive prescription. And look, you're doing two things when you're doing that, right? You're with a friend and you're talking, you're walking sort of, you know, in this synchronized motion, and you're also outside. So you get the double dose of goodness there, right? And sort of in that you're mobilizing, you're doing something and you're talking, and there's nothing better than actually that social connection piece that I think we often miss. Psychology has become so interiorized, so focused on the individual, how am I feeling at any given moment? And, you know, I went to medical school years ago and I studied psychiatry and residency, and I got really good at misery. I got really good at kind of trying to figure out what was wrong with somebody and what's your diagnosis and how can I treat that? And then I got fired actually by a patient one day who I'd been seeing for a little while. And she said, you know, all we ever do is really talk about what's wrong in my life. And sometimes I'm even having a decent day and I think I've got to think about what can I complain about here? What can I vent about? And I was taken aback, but she was right. And I, you know, it got me really thinking, what am I missing here? I'd been so focused on, you know, her issues with her partner, her stress with her kids, her work-life imbalance. And we were sort of trying to focus on her complaints so much, it never really occurred to me to think about what makes life worth living for her. I was so, it was like in this either or world that I was just focused on what was wrong and not focusing on what was strong. And I ended up going back to school to study positive psychology. It was the very opposite of what I had learned in medical school and psychiatry residency. And I heard words like optimism and resilience and post-traumatic growth. And thinking about, it's not just pathogenesis, which is the study and treatment of disease, but salutogenesis, which is the creation of health. And that brings me back to you going for a walk with your friend is part of salutogenesis. It is boosting and bolstering your mental health. And even you can have stress, but it's a both and, not an either or.
You made me think about something. You know, we're both physicians, so my background's internal medicine and critical care. I was forbidden to be positive. Okay. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, come on, you know, and I know. So we're going to have like a little doctor to doctor thing here. I mean, seriously, they would think you were some kind of happy wappy moron or something instead of, you know, like, get serious. There's something wrong. You know, there's a little extra protein in that urine and, you know, all the rest of it. But I'm like, I don't know. This person's kind of enjoying life right now. And why don't we just sort of sit down and actually, I don't know, do something radical like talk to them and figure out what their priorities are in life before we start dictating, commanding. And I still remember like it was yesterday doing medical consult on surgery. Somebody said, let's go see the gallbladder in 302. Yes. I said, is there like a human being attached to that? I'm just asking, you know, maybe it's a stupid question, but do you even know this person's name? And do you understand their history enough to know what their priorities are when you're sitting there telling them prognoses and treatment and strategies? And I'm like, you know, so I've always defined myself, I kind of made this up, but I'm sure maybe it came from somewhere. Who the hell knows? I look at myself as a realistic optimist. Does that sound weird?
No, it sounds so healthy. And I think that idea of, you know, when you would see the gallbladder, you know, in room three, or the diabetic in room two, and then we would go in there and start finger wagging at them. Like, there's a word Martin Seligman uses. He says, we start shoulding on people. Like, you should do more of this, and you shouldn't, without actually paying attention to who this person is. Why would they want to quit smoking? Because we tell them they should? Absolutely not. You know, and when you kind of can tap into their values, like, what matters to you? Oh, I really care about spending time with my grandson, or being able to throw a ball with him outside, and think about, like, sort of what is meaningful to them. That's how we can motivate behavior change, when we sort of tap into the human being. And in psychiatry, it's especially concerning, you know, when we talk about the schizophrenic, you know, down the hallway, or the anxiety disorder. And also with those labels, sometimes we've become so quick to slap them onto somebody. And then immediately, well, here's a treatment for that. And everything sort of just will make them, will dial down their misery in some way. And we're missing this whole part of their humanity. Like, how do we tap into what they care about? And, you know, and I worry, I find more, and I wonder if you do too, that people are much more, they're labeling themselves more as well. Like, I'm meeting younger patients who are coming in saying, I have an anxiety disorder, from a survey, like on TikTok. They're like, you see, I think I am autism spectrum disordered, or I have bipolar disorder. And I'm concerned about that, because it's sort of shifting their self-concept a little bit. Like, oh, if I think I have this anxiety disorder that I've labeled myself with, I think I'm not going to go to that social event after work, or I think I'm not going to take that interview, because it sort of shifts their behavior then in what they end up doing, or they use it as an excuse to distance themselves when they're feeling overwhelmed, to be avoidant. That's something I've been seeing more and more.
Yeah, they go to Dr. Google and Dr. TikTok, and they listen to these impossibly mixed up, crazy, misconceived notions about what's going on out there. And then they say, oh, that's me, I relate. And then they give themselves a label. What's with people and labels? Why do they just walk in and they go, hi, my name is Anne, and these are my feelings, but there's no label with it. What does giving yourself a psychiatric or psychological whatever label do for somebody?
I think it can be extremely helpful when it explains someone's behavior. And I think we're all looking for shortcuts in a way to explain others and to explain ourselves. You know, they say it was sort of with, if your vision was blurred, if your eyes had been dilated and you see something with four legs and a back, you'll sort of be like, oh, that looks like a chair. You know, but maybe it isn't. Like, we sort of have tremendous relief when we can hang our hat on something and say, like, oh, that's what it is. And I've had patients have, you know, find tremendous relief who have bipolar disorder saying, oh, wait, that's mania, or wait, I was in the midst of depression, and trying to sort of understand a treatment plan around that and what they might need in terms of medication and treatment. That said, I'm much more worried about the person who's coming in with, from Dr. Google, I have this or I have that, because 10 years ago, I used to treat what we call it, like, the worried well. People who encountered some, like, like, they were at some inflection point in their lives, problems in their relationship, at work, something going on, but they wanted to feel better. People now just want me to give them a confirmation of a diagnosis. Like, they sort of want that label. They'll say, like, I know this, just confirm that for me. And it's sort of, I'm reluctant to do that. And also because oftentimes, like, just because you've got this checklist and some of these things going around TikTok, like, do you not want to put your laundry away? Like, that means you have ADHD. No, it doesn't. Who wants to put their laundry away? You know, so it's just sort of, they'll cherry pick these symptoms and decide that that's what they have, and kind of moving people away from that and trying to think, okay, what are you doing? Like, what's your plan? How can you tackle that? And going back to that sense of feeling overwhelmed, I think they're feeling more overwhelmed actually when they hang on their hat on these, like, sort of TikTok diagnoses.
When we return, I'm going to ask Dr. Boardman, three grounding questions that she asks when people have the urge to shut down. The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. Okay. Now, in this beautiful blog that you wrote, you said, okay, fine, everyone wants to shut down, do the turtle thing. You begin to ask these questions, and I love the way you frame them. The first one is, which strength will I use? Now, what does that mean?
I think it sort of helps reframe that sense of feeling overwhelmed, because sometimes I think when we are feeling engulfed by a flood, that all we can think about is our vulnerabilities and our weakness and how overwhelmed that we are. And when you sort of turn to your strengths and think, wait a minute, I've got this whole buffet table of strengths that I have that I can maybe mobilize in this moment. And one of the best ways to get to that is to think about a time when you were at your best. Like, what is a time when you felt in the past challenged or overwhelmed, or you were tackling a difficult situation? What did you do? Okay, tell me about which strengths do you think were you using? Were you patient? Were you curious? Did you turn to somebody else? Did you, what did you do? And how could you potentially in this moment apply those strengths to this situation? And suddenly you see their posture change, literally, because it gives them some perspective. If that person has a hard time coming up with sort of that strength, like that immediate sense of strength, like what they would use, you can even say, tell me, what advice would you give to a friend in this moment? And again, it helps them step outside of themselves and they suddenly see it with a different perspective. Ah, well, I would obviously tell them they need to, do A, B, and C. It just gives you a different way to frame the issue. So you can kind of help pinpoint and dissect what the issues are when you step outside of yourself. This isn't a moment for self-immersion. This is a moment to gain some distance from yourself. And that might be thinking about the strengths you've used in the past or stepping outside of yourself and that advice you'd give to a friend.
Well, I think that as you were speaking, it reminds me of the fact that people themselves concentrate on what's wrong with them. In other words, front of mind are all the screw-ups, the epic failures, the issues they've had, instead of saying, wait a minute, I was actually quite successful with X, Y, and Z. And then you are telling them to examine, how were you successful? What actually happened? What were the tools in your tool chest that you grabbed to be able to be successful? And I think that that's so important. Yeah, I'm going to be a little gender specific here. I just love going out on limbs and making things up as I go along. But here we go. I think women are much harder on themselves than men. I think women look at themselves and go, you talk about should. How about shoulda, coulda, woulda? All right, let's just add the whole trifecta. If only I had XYZ, what a miserable failure I am. Look at me right now. I could have been so much, there's your coulda, and I would have been, and shoulda, and it goes on, and it's like, whoa, wait a minute, you're going down the rabbit hole. Let me pull you up. Let's have a conversation about your epic triumphs. Let's look at those for a minute, just for grins. I just think that women really drag themselves down much more. What do you think?
I 100% agree with you. And I certainly see that with my patients. And it's sort of accomplishment amnesia is what I call it. Like, we literally get blind spots. And I think sometimes, unless we are forced to remind ourselves, like, wait, what about that time? I mean, I often find this with patients, like, wait, you know, what about that time you dealt with that really difficult person at work? You know, and they'll be like, oh, wait. And they literally need to be like shaken to be reminded of that. And I'm not against looking at our failures. I think there is tremendous value in looking at what we've done wrong. And I saw this professor at Stanford does this great thing, is she asks all of her students to write a failure resume. And they actually write down sort of where they screwed up personally, professionally, royally, in every way. And then write in another column, sort of write down those accomplishments and sort of disasters and failures in one column. And then next to that, what did you learn from that? Like, create this failure resume, because I think that's also what we forget. We forget what we learned from those challenges and where we actually rose to them and were able to navigate them with grace, with fortitude, and with resilience. And sometimes we need a really good friend. It doesn't have to be a therapist. You know, sometimes it's listening to a good podcast, Dr. Pete's, but you know, that you have that where you're like, oh yeah, I got this. Like, what about that time I did that thing? And all these things in our rearview mirror, like it's hard, I think, for women to turn around and see it and to feel it. But that's what I think great friendships are for. And that's where we're sort of constantly learning and moving that forward.
I just love the whole issue. I remember reading about the failure resume, and I thought that was just the best ever. Because, you know, what I would like to do with every single one of these times when things didn't work out swimmingly, what did you learn? Because the whole point is a lesson or two or three or four, and write them down. Like, what did you learn? One of the things that kind of got me used to doing that in general, by the grace of heaven, was sports. It's like, honey, sometimes things just don't go well. I'm a triathlete and, you know, I got three sports to screw up on. So it could be like, I didn't tie my shoes well for the run. That was dumb. I can't get out of my wetsuit to save my life. I have to put more grease on next time. You know, it's just, it's hysterical. It's actually very funny. And if you're hanging out with a cool tribe of athletes, then we all laugh together because we've all been there. But you know what it does? It hones and refines the skill of looking at screw-ups, you know, like, yes, what happens and what did you learn? Then what are you going to apply going forward? Screwing up is not going to help you if you don't even take the lesson and do something with it. You've got to actually expand your knowledge base. And so I've found doing some level, you know, it doesn't have to be like elite sport or anything. It's just, you know, your weekend stuff, you know, like, how did pickleball go this weekend? Oh, rot-row. Okay, you did what? So what are we learning about? But you apply that to your life too. There's a lot of rot-row moments. And what are you learning? That's what you teach a kid, right?
Totally. And I was just going to say, I think for all your listeners who are parents out there, that this is invaluable for them, is to actually model for their kids, because kids, no matter what, do sort of elevate their parents, well, until they're teenagers and then they think they're total losers, but they do put them on this pedestal. And I think sharing that, like that pickleball game, I completely messed up, and hearing us talk about and actually modeling things and doing hard things, things that we're not necessarily good at or that don't come naturally to us. And even maybe it's a sport that is a little harder, like maybe it's golf for you, or like something that isn't as obvious, that wouldn't be in your wheelhouse of sports that draw you to, doing hard things and modeling that and letting our kids watch us make mistakes and try things that are hard and have setbacks is really also, I think, tremendously important, because it's not obvious to them. And I think that perfectionism piece is what you're talking about, is what we're really fighting here. And it seems to be an epidemic right now, perfectionism. And it's not just, I was just looking at a new study saying, it's not just that individuals feel that they need to be perfect right now, but they also have this expectation that the other people in their lives need to be perfect. And if they're not, they're dismissed as toxic, terrible people, you know, that your teachers need to be perfect, your therapist needs to be perfect, your doctor needs to be perfect, your family needs to be perfect. And sort of making space for that imperfection for others as well as oneself is really important.
It teaches one humanity to respect and honor the humanness in every single person out there. I personally celebrate the freckles and flaws of life. I think it's hysterical. I just go back to, you know, a memory whenever I say this of, you know, what was supposed to be. I remember, you know, I was invited to a beautiful wedding, and the young woman is a dear friend of mine who's in the, also in the medical profession, and she said, everything's going to be perfect. It's going to be perfect. And then I said to myself, I said, oh no, she's going down the rabbit hole and, yeah, and she's starting to do that. And I just, there's nothing I could have said. You know what I mean? It's like, whatever. So I'm sitting up front, because they wanted me to be up there with the family and whatever. And sure to form, you know, she's got like 95 bridesmaids and, you know, the whole thing had to be like a Lauren Sanchez, Jeff Bezos kind of thing. And as one of the bridesmaids, you know, came up to the altar, this is a Catholic church wedding, she just face planted. It was the funniest ass thing I've ever seen. So, you know, her dress went flying up, everyone can see. So she had a moment. And what had happened was she was doing a little champagne back there, and she's one of those wusses who can't handle, you know, a glass. She probably did too. And so she face planted. And that was it. You know, I'm going to ask you a question. Can you remember perfect weddings? No, there's nothing to remember. It's just too perfect. But when someone face plants, you remember that one. Yes. And it becomes the best ever. And so since I'm a physician, I keep running up to the altar like, oh God, what happened to this chick? And, you know, we took care of the whole thing and she was kind of hauled off. And next thing I know, it was right at that time in the wedding when you're supposed to, you know, kiss the bride and then come down the, you know, the aisle and everything. And I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, I'm still standing here. It's like I'm in a wedding. And so I thought, oh gosh, what's the very polite way of, you know, like, getting out of here, heading toward the exit. And instead, the priest came over, offered me his arm, and he said, we shall walk down together. Oh. It was hysterical. It became, seriously, the video of the year. They all wanted to see it. The face plant, Dr. Pika. Okay, that's why perfection to me is no fun. Perfection equals paralysis.
Yes.
You just become so anxious. It's like an anxiety generating machine when you do that kind of thing. You're overwhelmed with the wedding. We go back to the issue of overwhelm. You're overwhelmed with all the stuff. No, chill out, man. And if something wild and crazy happens, rock on. You know, that could be really cool in the video and whatever. Now, this brings us to this next question that you asked in the piece. And I really kind of really like this question. You know, whom will I reach out to? I think here's where men flub it, okay? Because they don't want to ask for help. They don't even ask for directions, so you can forget help. Women, I don't know. What do you think?
I just think we're reluctant to, and there is still this go-it-alone mindset, you know, that we think, like, we should handle this on our own, and that this all sort of Atlas carrying the world on our shoulders, that we should deal with it on our own. And it is unbelievable when you can just turn to someone and say, can you help me out here? I need your help. And most often people are thrilled and we don't ask enough and our friends are thrilled. How can I lend a hand? Let me tell you about the time this happened to me. I can maybe help you navigate this situation. It's, you know, we know good food tastes better when shared with a friend. A steep hill feels less steep when we're walking up side by side with somebody. Even, you know, with somebody's holding our hand, pain feels less severe. It even registers in our brain differently when we're sort of, we feel supported and comforted by others. And that's that sense of connection, and that people are so busy working on themselves and quantifying themselves and how many steps did I take? But I'd rather know, like, who did you spend time with this week? How are you cultivating those connections in your life? Because they are your life raft. Those people, like, that's your rocket ship, your friends. And, you know, relationships are a verb. You need to be working on them, actively showing up for people, being there for people, reaching out to people. And it's not just during tough times. It's also having good friends during good times. They're the ones who see opportunities for us that we might not see for ourselves. They're the ones who say, hey, you look like you're having a good time at that dinner chatting with that person. Are you going to follow up? They're the ones who You know, people are these days, I think of all these graduation speeches saying like, oh, do you have a good therapist? And I'm thinking, do you have good friends in this room? Who are the people you're cultivating and actively cultivating? Because it cannot just be a once in a while thing. Relationships are a verb. And I think those people you feel like you can reach out to, those three or five people, they're going to help you navigate the most difficult challenges, but they're also going to help you find the humor in that wedding. They're also going to sort of help you just make light of a situation. They're also going to help you reach your potential.
Piling on that, you mentioned in this beautiful blog, someone who had basically a cluttered basement and they needed to clean it out. I'll tell you why a lot of people, especially a woman, less so a man, okay, it's a woman. What they're going to do is they're going to say to themselves, shoulda, coulda, woulda, about the basement. How in the hell did I ever allow this to get to be such a mess? What was I thinking? I'm a mess, and now I am officially embarrassed, and now I go down another rabbit hole, something I love to call the shame, blame, and guilt rabbit hole, which is I feel so ashamed of the fact that I let it get to this place. So when you think about who to reach out to, it's like, I don't know. What if I reach out to someone who's judgy? They're like, oh, well, I would never have allowed my house to, you know, versus what? So when you're talking about making connections, the people I find most valuable are the ones who are non-judgmental, who just love you for who you are, you know, freckles and all, someone who's just going to tell a true truth, which is, hey, it's kind of a clutter down here, but you know something, the way I look at it, we should be done with this in about, say 3-4 days. Let's come up with a strategy and a plan and whatever. And then that person never laid that on you. I think women are exquisitely sensitive to shame, blame, and guilt. They're like, what's wrong with me? See, here we go again. What's wrong with me? It's that wrong thing versus what you love to talk about because you understand that whole world of positive psychiatry, which is what's right with you that's going to make all of this okay. What do you think?
I totally agree. And that your point about sort of judginess is really well taken. And like having those people in our lives, and it's like, who are we cultivating is our friendships? And especially like, I do see this among my sort of mom clients, is they feel very judged often by other moms and sort of the shoulding that occurs in those relationships. And the people that they feel comfortable with, who they feel that have their backs, it makes such a difference. And I think we often underestimate in our relationships, though, like that kind of, you know, like when you just feel free with somebody, you feel that they're not going to judge you. You feel that you can say anything to them and they can say anything to you. And how do we cultivate those relationships? And sometimes, and maybe this is an interesting thing for listeners to hear, is that we don't say it enough to those people. Like we don't necessarily express gratitude. We don't express our appreciation to somebody who is just there for us, who is that non-judgy person, because we assume they know it already. Or, gee, Dr. Peake, it would be too awkward for me to put it into words to say thank you for just being a force field in my life. And just say it. You don't have to write a long letter to somebody. Do, by all means, if you feel like it, but just put it into words, even put it into a text, even, but just make those people feel valued in your life and that you really appreciate them and express that gratitude. Just put it out there, because we too often keep that gratitude piece to ourselves and don't put it out into the world. And it's not doing anybody any good when we're hanging on to it. Say it to them, share it with them, lift them up with it, because I think it's going to be really well received.
I just love creating a really cool tribe. These are tribal members. And the tribal rules are telling your true truth, non-judgmental, being there to support one another. And it takes a while to collect these little awesome characters in our life. It's work. You have to go out there and you can't just sort of wish and hope. So to your point, creating the connections, I think, is insanely important. But then we go back to social media and everything, and all people do is text, and all they do is, you know, like do Zoom and whatever. And they're not even like, can I see you? Like actually see your body? And can we like meet up and whatever? And instead there seems to be an arm length distance between people sometimes. And I think we have to fight that. It's so much easier to just rip out a text instead of actually saying, hey, can I meet you for coffee? You want to go hiking? How about a little cycling this weekend? And then just bonding over the craziness of it all. I think that those people who show up, who was it who said, I think it was Jeffrey Hall. Yeah, he was just on again. He's another repeat offender who came up with it was the 200-hour rule on making a friend. You've got to eventually sit down and actually, I don't know who the hell calculated this, but good luck with that. Some postdoc who desperately needed a paper. But it's like 200 hours of getting to know someone and really being there for them. When you think about that, that's really putting in some time. As I've reflected on like new friends and getting really close to certain people, yeah, you're putting in time.
It's work, and it's great work, but it's so rewarding. But when it's those, you know, they say that it's shared experiences. It's stuff you do together. Like, so going back to your walk in the park with a friend or going on a hike with somebody, that's like it's interwoven memories that we hang on to. Like that's what sticks with us. Much more rarely it's stuff we've just done by ourselves. And so those that sort of shared experiences are invaluable. And I've got a pet peeve I wrote about recently that when somebody texts, when they just say, love you, or HBD, like happy birthday, like is it that much effort to write happy birthday out, you know, or actually pick up the phone and say happy birthday? So if you are even texting, better face-to-face, obviously, is a much more sort of rewarding and valuable experience. But if you are texting, spell it out. It can't be that much effort.
Oh, come on now. You're just doing this with the Gen Z people. They're just all, you know, into it. I have Gen Z and millennials, and half the time I'm just like, you know, LMAO and, you know, and back and forth. You know, and I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. And I just sort of, I have to kind of swallow some of that. That's totally cool, whatever. It's just, honestly, what happened to just like a little bit more genuine connection, but whatever. So speaking of which, the third question was, what are the next steps? And I really love this one because what you said was, what's your strategy going forward? All right. So you had like a funky doom scrolling day where suddenly you felt like you were absolutely overwhelmed and, you know, your email box is, it looks like a tsunami of craziness going on in there. Your texts are blowing up. The headlines are just about ready to make your head explode. But what's your strategy? How do you now that you're much more aware, because you listen to Dr. Samantha Boardman, what's your strategy going forward to be more proactive and say, I'm not going to allow this to make me crazy? So what do you think?
Well, absolutely. So it's this idea that if I just keep thinking and talking about it, perhaps, that I'm going to feel better. No. What action are you going to take? What baby step to close that intention action gap? Whatever is going on in your head, it's just going to keep swirling there. You're going to keep ruminating about it. You know, that quote, like a, you know, trip of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Tell me that single action you are going to take that when I see you next week, that you're going to do that's going to help you get you closer to your goal, that's going to help you feel better. Maybe it is calling your friend and going for a walk in nature. Maybe it is reading that novel you wanted to sort of take some time, like some downtime and do for yourself. What is that thing that you're going to do and be accountable for it? It just can't live in your head because as we said, like happiness isn't all in your head. It's actually in those actions you take, the connections you make and how you participate. What are you going to do? And there is something in psychology called behavior activation, which is sort of the opposite of the way sort of Freudian and sort of traditional psychoanalysis works, which is that idea that how you feel shapes what you do. This is turning that on its head and saying, actually, what you do is going to shape how you feel. And we know that those actions you take, physically moving yourself or spending time with somebody else or doing something, is going to shift your mindset. So that's why I'm really like, I really want to get a concrete, specific plan that somebody's going to have. Like, what step are you going to take that is going to be fulfilling, that is going to give you a little bit of a boost?
It could be something as simple as this. I made this up as I went along. I'm all about the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex, because it is the CEO of the brain, right? And it's right behind our forehead. So what I do is I say, uh-oh, we're starting to go down that little rabbit hole. Stop for a moment. Take your finger, touch the middle of it. That's your pause button.
Oh, I love that.
Just hit your pause button.
I love that.
Yeah. Why? Because it's active. You're not like, I'm going to consider pausing. No, screw that. Just take your damn, you know, index finger and touch your forehead. And then what you're doing is you're kind of communing with your frontal cortex. And now you're saying, well, wait a minute, because that CEO of the brain is in charge of reining in anxiety, irritability, impatience, organizing, strategizing. So you're reminding yourself like, whoa, wait a minute. Okay. I don't want that rabbit hole. Now I'm going to be more reflective. I'm going to be much more mindful of what my next intention is going to be. My intention is not to go down a rabbit hole. It ain't going to happen. No. And so there you go. That's why I like this, take the next step, because in many respects, it's what we said in the beginning, Samantha, and that is you've got to take the experience and you've got to find that lesson, that life lesson. I always say there's a pony in there somewhere. And, you know, find the life lesson. And how's that going to help you? Where are we going with that? And pluck it. And it's just like this fantastic gift to yourself and run with it. That's what you want more than anything else. So I loved these questions that you asked because I thought that they were so important, you know, redefining the narrative, finding out to whom you're going to connect to be able to help you with this. And then from all those learnings and lessons, how are you now going to go forward with a different strategy to proactively nip this little hummer in the bud so that you feel less overwhelmed? Now, we're not clearly saying, yeah, you're never going to feel overwhelmed. I mean, all of us do at some point in time. No question about it. Okay, absolutely no question. What we're trying to do is tamp it down and manage it better, cope with it better, and then move forward. So your last thoughts on this, Samantha?
Well, it's putting it into perspective. And I think that for any listeners who might find it helpful, if they're living with somebody who feels overwhelmed, you know, it's also these questions can be very helpful to help that person kind of develop more of like, rather than that internal fixation, that avoidance, that retreating that we were talking about at the beginning, these can be excellent questions to help that person reframe. So it's not just for you, it's also for the people you love.
I love it. That's fantastic. Tell us about your book, Everyday Vitality.
Thanks. I loved writing this book, and it was really based on my experience in positive psychiatry that was the opposite of everything I had learned in my training, and applying it in everyday ways. I think there was so much overwhelming messaging about, you know, you have to go and find yourself and eat, pray, love your way to happiness and do things. And I was really interested in concrete everyday ways that you can give yourself a boost. And that's really what the book is about. And I'm working hopefully on a new book that hopefully maybe you'll invite me back on when I'm ready to talk about it, that we can discuss.
Give us a teaser. Just generally, is it more positive psychiatry?
It's more positive psychiatry. And really the idea is that you are stronger than you think. And I want to help you sort of draw from that strength and share it with the world and share it with others.
I love it. That's fantastic. Everyone, we have been talking with Dr. Samantha Boardman, who is a positive psychiatrist. I love this, you know, and really has a way to spin a practical narrative about how you can actually take all of that feeling of overwhelm and turn it into a very valuable life lesson and develop new tools in the tool chest that you have right next to you to be able to live a fantastic life. Dr. Boardman, thank you so much for being on the HER podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Peek. It was a pleasure and an honor.
And I want to thank my sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs Rooted in Nature, and the new HER Life Stages products. You need to scope it all out at Solaray.com. And hey, take a moment and leave us a review, because we just sit around just waiting for these reviews. We love it, love it, love it. This has been a production of Podcast Health. And I got a little something for you to remember. You know, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So come on, get on out there, seize the day, a little carpe diem. Thanks for listening, everyone.